It is Monday here at KPCW. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
The core of big business in America has traditionally been the publicly traded company, companies that are subject to an array of regulations. But in the last few decades, private equity has been increasing its presence on the American corporate landscape. Some 12 million people work for companies owned by private equity firms, and that's some 8% of the employed population. These firms generate $1.7 trillion of the GDP. They also accounted for 11% of corporate bankruptcies in 2024. Journalist Megan Greenwell examines how private equity works by telling the stories of four American workers whose lives were affected by the industry in her new book, Bad Company: Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, the book starts by talking a little bit about your experience. How did your own experience inspire you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
So, I was the editor-in-chief of a digital sports magazine called Deadspin. Deadspin was really my dream job. It was where I wanted to work for years, and so when I got the editor-in-chief job there, I was sort of like, great, I will stay as long as they will have me. And I only lasted about a year and a half because a little over a year into my tenure, we got purchased from Univision, the Spanish language broadcaster, by a small Boston-based private equity firm called Great Hill Partners. And, you know, I thought we needed to get purchased. Like, I was sort of like, this is good because we need to be making more money. Deadspin was profitable. But they hadn't done that much to, like, boost our profits. And I wanted us to make more money. And instead, what happened was they came in and pretty immediately started cutting many of our most profitable forms of content. And I got driven out of my job within about 3 months. And I was really baffled by why they weren't trying to strengthen our business. And I had written an essay on my last day at Deadspin about my experience there. And I had had people say, you know, you should expand this into a book. I did not want to write a book about my personal experience. But after I left Deadspin, I stayed really obsessed with how private equity works in various industries and why there's this split in incentives that leads to firms doing things that are actively bad for their own portfolio companies. And so it took me about 6 months after I left Deadspin to decide to write a book. And then I ended up settling on this schema where I have four primary protagonists. I followed each of them for about 2 years each. And the result was Bad Company.
How does private equity typically work, and how do private equity firms typically make their money?
The way private equity works is they bundle money from different forms of investors. So these can be sovereign wealth funds, university endowments, public pension funds, ultra-wealthy individuals, what have you. But they combine that money with bank loans to buy companies. And in fact, the bank loans represent about 70 to 80% of the average private equity deal. And the trick with private equity is those loans, which can be huge, you know, stretching well into the billions of dollars, the responsibility for that debt is assigned not to the firm that has made the decision to take out the money, but actually assigned to the portfolio company itself. So if I'm a private equity firm who wants to buy the Mountain Money show, I can take out $1 million in loans to do that. And if I drive Mountain Money out of business, out of existence, only you are responsible for paying back that money, not me. And so you do end up with this split in incentives where what is good for me as the private equity firm is very often not what is good for the company I am controlling, which ends up being, I argue, sort of a corruption of free market capitalism, because theoretically the way to make money is by strengthening a business, but that's not what happens in a lot of private equity cases.
Yeah, the economics textbook would say, oh, this is a device whereby, you know, someone can come in and revitalize the company, inject capital, add expertise, make a better mousetrap, build the company up, and then sell it. And I guess that does happen sometimes. But it's not all that typical, or it's not certainly the uniform experience that you find in these private equity deals.
Yeah, exactly. So people often conflate private equity and venture capital.
Right.
And venture capital is a much simpler system, right? If you are an investor, you invest some X money in whatever company it is, and then you get that percentage of whatever their future profits are. Private equity is very different from that because you don't have to strengthen the actual company. In many cases, it ends up not being in your interest to strengthen that company at all, because strengthening the fundamentals of a business is long, hard, slow work. And private equity is by definition a short-term game. And so if you can sell off all the assets, sell the real estate, you know, make money off your management fees, and drive the company into the ground, that may very well make you more money than, you know, amortizing it over the time it takes to build up the business.
So how often is private equity successful in as far as revitalizing companies by injecting capital and adding expertise?
Private equity started in the 1960s, and it started with what they called bootstrap deals, which were essentially, you know, take a small family-run company that shows the potential to grow, but maybe doesn't have the capital they need to do it, and inject that capital, and then help the company go public or sell for a big exit, whatever it is. What ended up happening after that was the appetites just got more and more and more rapacious, right? So they started taking over larger and larger and larger companies. And so it seems like by all accounts, there are plenty of small, reasonably successful private equity deals for small companies. But the biggest deals are the ones that are unsuccessful the greatest percentage of the time. So 10 times as many companies owned by private equity firms enter bankruptcy proceedings as other types of companies.
So the book, as you mentioned, you follow four individuals. I found each of the stories pretty compelling, but let's start with Liz, the Toys R Us supervisor. What was her career like prior to the buyout, and how did the buyout change the way the company operated?
So Liz had worked her entire career in retail, and she went to work for Toys R Us specifically because she liked how their business was run. Liz is a real researcher, and she knew she would have to support her family on a Toys R Us, you know, on a retail salary for several years while her husband was earning a pharmacy degree. Her Toys R Us career took her and her family from Alaska to Oregon because there was no pharmacy school in the state of Alaska. And so they had to move. And she was very happy at Toys R Us. She didn't even know private equity owned her company, right? And why would she? This was something I heard from workers over and over again. Until it goes wrong, you don't know that there's a private equity firm in charge, because her paycheck said Toys R Us. Her bosses, seven or eight levels above her, were all workers for Toys R Us. And so it was really when there was a catastrophe that she finally figured out, wait, this is what's actually been going on below the surface.
And, you know, one of the things that struck me as I was reading the book was, and hearing her story, was the culture that it sounds like the employees of Toys R Us, not just Liz, but many of her coworkers, they were really into this. I mean, to the extent that, like, you know, they almost literally had Jeffrey emblazoned on their bodies.
No, quite literally.
Yeah.
Liz and a group of her colleagues actually got Jeffrey the Giraffe tattoos with the letters TRU for Toys R Us. So this was a company that had incredibly loyal workers. Liz said she would have stayed there for the rest of her career if that had been an option. Liz worked for a while at Babies R Us, which was the sister brand. And there you have this really intimate relationship with your customers where you're telling them what they need for their first baby. And you come to really rely on those workers. And that's a big reason that Babies R Us was really successful, even in the age of Amazon, right? Because if you're a scared first-time parent, you might not necessarily feel confident enough to order a car seat on Amazon and figure out how to install it.
Now, you mentioned Amazon, and I want to touch briefly on the question of whether the Toys R Us bankruptcy was an inevitable result of the pressures on bricks-and-mortar businesses, or whether a different answer might have happened had not the private equity group taken the approach it did to the assets.
Yeah, it's such a good question, because the private equity firms in charge essentially said, this wasn't our fault. You know, Amazon doomed a lot of retail. And it is true that Amazon was obviously a huge challenge for so many retail chains. But Toys R Us was sort of a uniquely powerful retail chain. There's a term in economics called category killers, which mean a chain that is so big that nothing else can survive in that category. And Toys R Us was the company for which that term was invented. So Toys R Us had a really strong standing, and plenty of retail chains have continued to survive and thrive well into the Amazon era, right? We all see retail chains all around us at all times. I think the problem with Toys R Us was they weren't able to deal with the Amazon threat because all of their profits were being swallowed up by interest payments. The two private equity firms that bought Toys R Us had taken out $5 billion in loans. So even when Toys R Us was profitable on a strict sales versus costs level, between 90 and 120% of their profit margins were being swallowed up by interest payments without ever touching the principal. It was true that Toys R Us did need to change to survive in the age of Amazon, but the real problem was they didn't have the money to evolve because all of their money was going to debt.
So just to back up a little bit, $5 billion is the responsibility of Toys R Us to pay. Yet they didn't get the $5 billion to rebuild. The private equity firm got the $5 billion.
Exactly. So that $5 billion was used just to acquire the company. None of that money was actually available for things like upgrading the in-store experience, creating a robust web presence, anything like that. And it was really interesting talking to Liz and other people who worked for Toys R Us at that time, because, you know, even rank and file store level workers were saying, look, these stores feel incredibly outdated and chaotic. We're saying just make some basic improvements so they're more friendly to customers. And Toys R Us was essentially saying there's no money with which to do that.
The Toys R Us story is particularly interesting because after the bankruptcy, there was a dramatic effect, obviously, on the many employees. Let's talk a little bit about what happened to those employees and what did Liz and others do in reaction?
33,000 Toys R Us workers were laid off when Toys R Us liquidated. And those folks, though they were guaranteed severance in the event of a layoff in their contracts, they were laid off with no severance because it was a bankruptcy issue. And that obviated their right to severance that was outlined in their contract. And the Toys R Us workers were furious. And this story got a lot more media attention than a lot of private equity bankruptcies do, because people have such fond memories of Toys R Us, right? This is an American institution that had been around for generations, and so many generations of people just loved Toys R Us. And so these workers, I think, did a very smart thing, which was they really tried to keep public attention on them and on the cause of we were treated unfairly and we deserve severance. So they did a lot of awareness campaigns. They went and stood in front of public pension boards and said, look, we don't think you should invest in these private equity firms until they agree to treat workers better. And they really kept the heat on to the point that the firms finally agreed to create, they wouldn't call them severance payments, they called it a hardship fund. But that was the direct result of worker action. You know, they were able to get some sort of money out of this even after losing their jobs.
I'm going to jump over to Wyoming and Roger Goese. So can you give us a little bit about Roger's career before the HCA acquisition of the local hospital there?
Roger grew up in suburban Texas, suburban and big city Texas, and he really wanted to move to the Mountain West and really wanted to be a doctor in a rural community. So he specifically sought out a job in the late 70s in very rural Wyoming, Riverton, Wyoming, which is the 10th largest city in the state with about 10,000 people, because he wanted to be a community doctor doing it all. Roger is now in his late 80s and mid 80s and is, you know, very inspirational to me because he really just like did the hard thing. You know, he was at, early in his career, he was at a wealthy suburban hospital outside of Dallas. And he said, this is not the life I want. I want to move to rural Wyoming. And so until Apollo Global Management took over his hospital through a chain of rural hospitals called LifePoint, he was thrilled. He felt like he was living the dream. And this was not an easy life by any stretch, but it was what he wanted to do. And then LifePoint just started stripping all of the services that this hospital had once provided. You know, this was a rural hospital, so they weren't doing complex oncology procedures or anything like that. But they were able to do, you know, basic general surgery, delivering babies, and all of the sort of tentpole things that you think of any normal hospital being able to do. And all of a sudden, all of that was disappearing. And because this is a rural community, that was leaving people really high and dry because there was not another hospital for 30, 35 miles. That hospital was also owned by Apollo Global Management. And so the result was all of these folks that Roger had dedicated his entire life to caring for were not able to get even basic medical services.
And of course, this leads to another It's a rather inspirational story in the book. What did the community do in response as it became increasingly clear that the services that the community needed from a healthcare perspective were gradually being phased out?
Yeah, so for a long time, Roger and his colleagues and his neighbors really tried to fight to save the hospital. They actually had a group, a formalized nonprofit that they called Save Our Riverton Hospital. And after years, they realized that they were, you know, trying to negotiate with this huge, powerful force who was based thousands of miles away and frankly did not care about Riverton, Wyoming. And so at that point, they shifted tactics and they said, okay, then we're going to create a hospital ourselves. And when I first heard about this, I remember thinking, that's cute, right? Like that
exactly.
is sweet and naive. And like, of course, this random group of people in small town Wyoming cannot raise enough money to build an entire hospital from scratch. And what ended up happening is they have broken ground on a new community-owned hospital. They've been very clever about it. They got a bunch of money from USDA, actually the largest low-interest loan in the history of USDA in Wyoming. They partnered with a nonprofit health management organization in Billings, Montana, to provide a lot of their centralized services so they won't have to pay for a lot of that themselves. Yeah, they broke ground in December. There was a big ceremony in June when the ground thawed. They have a very active Facebook page where they're documenting the construction of this hospital. And they're going to have a real functioning community hospital just because a group of, you know, run-of-the-mill, everyday people banded together and decided to make it happen.
And is Roger Goh still involved?
Oh, yes. Roger was on the board, remains on the board of this new hospital that they're calling Riverton Medical District. He was, you know, one of the very most active people in terms of determining, here's what our hospital needs to have, here's where we should go look for the money, all of that kind of stuff. And Roger's well into his 80s now. He could just be kicked back and retiring. And, you know, he loves to travel, loves to go to tennis tournaments. He and his wife are still very active. But he said, I want to leave this community better than I found it. And for a long time, I felt like I had done that just by providing patient care. But then Apollo Global Management managed to tear down so much of what we had built that the only way for me to leave this community better than I found it in 1979 is to help make this hospital a reality. And so he has been as involved as anyone.
I don't know that we're going to get to all four of these fascinating characters, but I do want to ask about Natalia. What does the career of Natalia tell us about the effect that private equity is having on the availability and quality of local journalism?
Yeah, Natalia is a really interesting one to me. She got into journalism at her community college in El Paso, Texas. And then she just, you know, wanted to dedicate her entire life to being a reporter. And she got a job at the Corpus Christi Caller Times. I'm sorry. She went to community college in Corpus Christi, Texas, not El Paso. But she got a job at the local newspaper in Corpus Christi, and that newspaper was taken over by Gannett. And she worked her way up to larger and larger newspapers in that chain. And Gannett was not outright owned by private equity, but heavily controlled by private equity, to the point that they were constantly laying people off, eliminating entire newspapers. Natalia ended up on the union committee at her newspaper in Indianapolis, and they just would not negotiate in good faith with the union. And so we're in this moment where obviously so few local newspapers have continued to survive and thrive. And you see these big chains responsible for massive numbers of losses, job losses in journalism, and devastating entire communities by taking away their ability to get basic information. And so Natalia's career at Gannett, I think, was a really clear indicator of how this trend has gone.
Well, let's jump over to Lauren. How large a presence in residential housing has private equity become?
So since the 2008 financial crisis, private equity has become absolutely huge in housing. And the financial crisis caused that by causing the price of housing to collapse, right? So all of a sudden, you see private equity firms rushing in because there's cheap money available. And so private equity now is very involved in almost every sector of housing. So mobile home parks, they're very, very big in. Single family houses, there was a recent study that showed there are several cities across the country where private equity owns like 30% or more of the single family housing there, and also huge apartment buildings. So I focus on Loren DePina, who was a tenant of a massive apartment complex in Northern Virginia, right outside of DC, and private equity was essentially interested in taking over that complex, in part because Amazon was building a second headquarters in the town next door to Alexandria. And so they thought, you know, this is a complex that serves mostly low-income people. And now all of a sudden, we can maybe make it more for like the software engineers and the, you know, fancy Amazon type of people. And so this was a complex that served not just low-income people, but a lot of immigrants and refugees. Those people were just treated absolutely terribly by CIM Group, which was the private equity landlord.
Okay. And so that story sort of tells us a lot about what's going on in the industry in general. I do want to go, as we're running out of time, I want to touch on some of the big pictures. Interestingly enough, on this program, Megan, I find us so often talking about a debt economist, Milton Friedman, as we're talking about different companies and the relationship between companies and shareholders and societies. From your perspective, to what extent does private equity's singular focus go beyond even what Milton Friedman envisioned as the role of shareholder value?
Yeah, this was so interesting to me because what I knew about Milton Friedman was he was the godfather of shareholder value theory, right? He was the one who was saying the only point of a company is to make money for shareholders. But when I went back to his famous New York Times essay that sort of outlined this theory, what I noticed was he actually says there should be carve-outs for types of industries that serve a public good of some sort. So he specifically names education and hospitals. Education and hospitals are now two of the biggest areas of investment for private equity. As, you know, ruthless as I think Milton Friedman was, and proudly so, about the only point of a business being to make money for its shareholders, even he was not talking about something quite as extreme as what the private equity system has built. And I do think, you know, that's really worth being clear about, because people say essentially, you know, look, this is just free market capitalism. But I actually really do believe that there is a corruption at play of what we think of free market capitalism as representing.
Private equity takes advantage of a number of favorable legal and regulatory provisions, such as the so-called carried interest provision, that almost everybody thinks is unfair. Why are the excesses of this industry so hard for policymakers to address?
The biggest reason is because 88% of members of the House and Senate receive money from private equity donations. That's across both sides of the aisle. So there's just not a lot of appetite for regulating this. Elizabeth Warren has proposed what she calls the Stop Wall Street Looting Act over and over and over again since 2018. And it's never come anywhere close to getting out of committee because she doesn't have nearly enough allies. And even the carried interest loophole, which would not be a fundamental regulation of private equity in the same way that the Warren bill would be, you know, that was shut down in 2021 by Democrats who said, look, we don't want this to happen. Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona ended up being the one to put the final nail in that coffin. So I think without a pretty dramatic change in the composition of Congress, you're unlikely to see serious attempts at private equity regulation on the national level. That said, there is a lot of interesting work being done on the state level in several places. So Oregon, just maybe 6 weeks ago, passed a major bill regulating private equity in healthcare. Pennsylvania is considering a similar bill. Massachusetts passed one last year. So I think there is an opportunity for some serious change on the state level. And I do think it's worth people remembering that there is power on the state and local level and not getting so discouraged by the lack of movement on the federal level that they just lose all hope for doing anything about this problem.
The book is Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Megan Greenwald, thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back after this. And joining us in the studio is Hannah Stoughton. She's the proud owner of Rendezvous Run, a brand new running store. Hannah, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. To start, can you give us a bit about yourself and what led you down the path to opening a running store?
Sure. So I moved here about 5 years ago with my family from Minnesota. My background's in product development in the material space and had done that for quite a few years after school. Did a lot of work in kind of the product development area for a couple of different companies. And about a year ago, realized I needed to just take a step back and see what was next for me. And
was that corporate
career.
America and product development?
Yeah.
So you were working for the man and you decided this is not really where I want to be.
It's not. Yeah. My passion, kind of my whole career up to this point was really in innovation. I loved the front end process of building new products and investigating, you know, kind of what the world needed around us. And that's really what motivated me in my work. Yeah, it got to a point where I was just ready for the next thing and the next thing to build. So I took a step back, took some time off last year, spent the whole summer up here in our beautiful community running and meeting a lot of people in the community, and just realized that it was a gap that we had here.
We are fortunate enough to interview a lot of local business people who have diverted from big corporations, big careers, to choose to be here and do a passion, mm-hmm. Do a passion project. So just to finish the story a little bit, what kind of products were you developing?
So my background was in filtration media. I was working kind of the filtration space for a long time. And then I started working in commercial cleaning products, oddly enough. And then most recently, I was working for a crafting company, so making crafting materials for iron-on and...
An obvious career path that leads one to opening a running store.
Obviously, yes.
So tell us the official name of the store.
It's called Rendezvous Run.
Okay, and where'd that name come from?
So when people were moving to the West, the rendezvous was the meetup point for lots of people from all sorts of different backgrounds and trades to come together to meet up, to trade goods, and it would turn into kind of a celebration every time they would come to these rendezvous. And that was really what we were trying to build here in Park City, was that meetup spot for runners and walkers and hikers to come together and have a community and a place to buy the products that they needed to get outside and enjoy this beautiful community. But really come together to just celebrate together.
We'll undoubtedly cover this again at the end, but where is the store located?
We are over in Kimball Junction in Redstone, just down from Sushi Blues.
And what's the atmosphere like when I walk into the store? What's the mood you're trying to create?
So we are a traditional sit and fit run specialty store, which is what I think makes us kind of unique in the outdoor retail industry. And the mood in the store, I hope, when you walk in, is that it's very fresh and bright and kind of curated. So we spent a lot of time trying to pick the right products, really high quality products that were going to help you get outside and enjoy the activities that we do here in Park City.
So tell us a little bit about the scope of your inventory. What are you selling there?
Yeah, absolutely. We have all of the major shoe brands. So Brooks, Saucony, Asics, New Balance, kind of all the shoe brands that you would expect in a run specialty store. We're working on getting in Hoka right now. We'll have On in later this year. So really trying to focus on those high quality run specific shoe brands. And then we also have apparel from a couple of different companies, and then gear and nutrition. So all of the nutrition you would need for a long day out on the trails, whether you're running, hiking, or biking, and then, you know, all of the accessories to go along with that.
Yeah. Now I walked into the store, last week, 2 weeks, whenever I walked in, and there was a treadmill. What is the treadmill there for?
So we work with Wahoo, which is also a really great partnership for us. So we have a Wahoo treadmill in the store. So when you come in to do a shoe fitting, we have actually a couple of pieces of technology in there. We partner with Cetus, who's another local Park City brand. Their specialty is in the ski boot industry. And they're starting to get into run insole fitting too. So we've partnered with Cetus on our shoe fitting technology. So kind of the way the process would work is you would come in, we would get you on our Cetus fitting machine. We'll look at the length and width and arch height of your feet and then do a little bit of gait analysis on the Cetus machine. We'll use that information to pick out the right shoes for you and combine that with some insoles. And then we'll get you on the treadmill and look at your gait, let you run in the shoes a little bit, and make sure that that's the right fitting shoe for you and meeting your goals.
So we're getting to the clear difference between purchasing a running shoe there and at the Nike outlet. So as part of this process, are you involved with orthotic implants or and explain sort of that part of fitting a shoe?
Absolutely. So we, as I said, we work with Cetus as our partner on insoles, and we do a semi-custom fit. So we'll look at your arch height and choose a couple of different insoles based on your activity and the shape of your feet and go through a process where we're making sure that that insole is right for your foot and your arch height. And then we'll cut that down to fit in your shoe. So it's more of a semi-custom approach, but a really nice way to customize shoes and your footbed to your feet.
So therefore, one shouldn't buy running shoes because they like the looks of them. They have to buy the ones that are made for their feet. I know hockey skates do that.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I have a weird foot, so I have to get a specific hockey skate. But I've never been a runner, but maybe I can become a runner if I got good shoes that didn't make my knees and my back hurt if I run.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do try to pick shoes that do look very nice too, but we'll never let you leave the store without the right shoe for you and for your activity and your body mechanics. That's really our goal.
So, Anna, is the inventory strictly running, or do you have hiking and other kinds of activity shoes as well?
We have a lot of trail shoes that are really nice crossover for hiking and walkers. Whether you're on the pavement or out on the trails, we have perfect shoes for all of those activities.
Now, if someone is a trail runner, so it's a little bit of hiking, a little bit of running. Are they wearing hiking shoes or running shoes?
Running shoes.
Running shoes, yeah, for trail running.
And we carry more shoes that are in that traditional trail running category that make a nice crossover for hikers. So less of the traditional high top hiking boots.
Gotcha. So now opening a business is a big challenge, isn't it?
It is.
Can you share with us some of the biggest challenges that you faced and how you overcame those challenges?
Yeah, great question. We kind of came up with the idea, I think I said it out loud first last September, and then went to a big running trade show that's every year in Austin in November to just start to meet brands and start to build those relationships and get them on board with kind of our plan and what we were trying to do here in Park City. Came back from the running event and said, okay, let's go. I think we can do this. So we found our space in February and we turned it around really quickly. So in about 70 days. And we had an amazing team involved with our build out process, which I learned is very, very important. And I think it was really just the speed of everything coming together because we were trying to capitalize on the beautiful weather through the summer and the fall. And mm-hmm. so we're really trying to keep it moving quickly so we could make sure we had product ready for people who are getting out on the trails right now. So just pulling all of those pieces together very quickly. I think my biggest learning from it was that we needed to just get the doors open and that people were going to be excited to just have the store open, be able to come in, even if, you know, on my end, everything wasn't perfect when we opened the doors.
Now, on the flip side, what's the most rewarding part of this journey for you?
Oh, I would say absolutely getting involved in the community. And the community response here has been so, so positive. It's been really rewarding to be in the store and just have people pop in and say, thank you so much for opening the store and bringing this to our community. It was really needed. And that's when we feel so grateful to be here and be in this, you know, amazing place and be able to provide this service to our community.
And how are you marketing? You open a new business. How do you get people to know that you're there and to understand what you're offering?
We have an Instagram presence, so you can follow us on Instagram at RNDVRUN, so shortened Rendezvous Run, on Instagram, and we post all of our events on there. We have run clubs through the week, Tuesdays at 6 p.m. and Fridays at 7 a.m., so I actually just came for one this morning. And after our 7 a.m. on Fridays, we do pancakes and coffee at the store and hang out, and we have a really nice time there.
So how does that event work? Let's take the Friday morning one. Do you publicize that you're gathering at a certain spot and then do the run from there? What does it work?
Right now, we're just meeting at the store.
Okay.
Yeah, so really consistent. And we do a really nice 3-ish mile loop through Willow Creek and then back to the store. So very...
To get the pancakes.
Yeah. come by for the pancakes.
And do you have to finish the full 3 miles to get the pancakes?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, so we're open to all paces. Some days we have folks who are just out for a 2 mile run, so they'll run out for a mile or maybe 10 minutes and then turn around and come back. So we're very open to whatever is right for people that day too.
Now, I love the idea that you have technology in the store to assist with something that's very manual. Running is very manual. Has the technology been difficult to grasp, or have you always had that technology and, you know, brain kind of working for everything that you might do in life?
Yeah, great question. Well, I've been a lifelong runner, so the running mechanics of it was very familiar to me. Learning the technology has been amazing with our CETUS partners. They have trainers that come into our shop and help us get comfortable with the technology and help new employees get comfortable with it. And they've made it really, really simple to understand. So when folks come in and they see their feet on the scanner, and it can even be self-guided, it's so, so convenient. So you could actually step through it yourself and learn all about your feet and your gait. But we're obviously there to help guide.
Now, if someone walks into your store for the first time, what's the one experience or takeaway you want them to take away with?
Yeah, I hope that when people leave, they feel a little bit more knowledgeable and feel confident to go out and do their activities. So we really have tried to, the big motivator for me was to make sure that the store was a very welcoming, inclusive place. I think that sometimes Park City can be a little intimidating, especially if you're getting into a new sport or a new hobby. So my goal was really to make sure that people felt comfortable, whether they were a super experienced trail runner or brand new to the sport or just out for a walk, that you could come in, feel comfortable to ask any questions, and that we're there to help educate you in any way and help you feel confident that you have the right gear and the knowledge to get outside.
Okay, Hannah, once again, can you remind us where the store is physically?
Yes, it's in Kimball Junction in Redstone on the block with Sushi Blues.
Before we go, your store hours and website.
Our website is rendezvousrun.com, and we're open 6 days a week. We're closed on Mondays, and we're open 10 to 6 through the week and 10 to 5 on the weekends.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your time, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Next, we're going to talk to the proprietor of a local business, Park West Bees and Honey. You may be familiar with him, so I'm going to ask Kevin Kennedy to cross to the proverbial other side of the microphone. Kevin Kennedy is, in addition to being my co-host on Mountain Money, the proprietor of Park West Bees and Honey. Kevin, thanks for talking about your business this morning.
Yeah, we kind of got thrown into this. We had a no-show.
Oh, so, we've been planning to do this for a while. So,
yeah.
Kevin, let's talk about this business. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you start this business? What inspired you to get into it?
Well, one of my friends in the Follies, Hunt Williams, is a beekeeper, and he got me involved in it a few years ago. And I really took to it. As a financial advisor, there's nothing scientific about what I do in the day job. And so this was a fun weekend escape.
So let's tell you, how do you start? I mean, you know, what, do you just buy? Where do you sort of? It's not like you can go to the corner store and buy a beehive.
No. You find another beekeeper who's selling what's called nukes. It's a nucleus of bees. It is going to be a box with 5 frames. It'll have honey. It'll have bees. It'll have a mated queen laying eggs. It'll have pollen in it. It's a starter hive. And from that, you put it into a 8 or a 10 frame box, add some extra frames, and care for it and make sure it's getting everything it needs. If there's not a good nectar flow going on, which means, you know, the flowers are all blooming and giving us nectar, then you just give them some sugar water and keep them building comb and growing.
And okay, so like, does it matter where you put a hive in this area?
Generally, you want to keep it in the sun. Even though it's hot in the sun, wintertime, you definitely want the sun to hit it and try to keep it warm, as warm as possible. And you want the entrance facing southeast so that the morning sun of the east will warm the entrance and get them motivated to come out and fly around and start foraging.
And any business that deals with live animals is going to have challenges. And so talk a little bit about what goes wrong in a beehive.
Wow, so there's some diseases they can get. There's a mite called the Varroa destructor. Great name. It's a tiny little mite that will weaken the bees and leave them susceptible for disease. If you don't treat for them, they could your hive could be dead by the end of winter. So you can test. I don't do much testing because I know the mites are around, so I just assume my bees have mites. So I'll treat them with something called an oxalic acid, and that will. It's a tricky thing because you're trying to kill one bug on another bug, so it has to be very fine with the killing of the Varroa destructor and keeping your bees alive.
Well, now it's not like you're a vet. You can get the puppy to sit there. How do you apply this material to the bees?
A few different ways. You can drizzle oxalic acid on top of the frames. The bees will step in it. They'll pass it around to one another. You can put some medium, like a cardboard soaked in glycerin and oxalic acid. It's a product called Varroxan. That will allow the bees to walk on it and pass it around. And then you also have a vaporizer. And you can put the oxalic acid in something that gets very hot, 250 to 300 degrees, and vaporize, put the oxalic acid throughout the entire hive, and that will that should kill as many Varroa destructor mites as possible.
Now, you've built this business. How many hives do you... You started with one, and I take it you can use your own hive to create other starter hives.
Yeah, you got okay. it. You know how
yeah,
you go.
Yeah. Kind of like a pyramid scheme. How many hives do you now have?
Somewhere between 25 and 30.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how much attention does each hive take a week?
Not too much. I usually get stuff done in the evenings or on the weekend, and it's enjoyable. My daughter comes out and helps me with it.
Do you guys get dressed up in those beekeeping costumes with the masks and stuff?
My daughter loves to put the full suit on. Yeah. She doesn't like the bees. I like to feel what's going on, so I will not wear gloves. I'll cover my face with a veil. And it depends on the hive. Yeah. Most hives are fairly gentle. I've got some friends with some hives that I'll help them out with, and they can be mean.
How often have you been stung?
One hive, I lost count at 8 stings. 6 of them were on my ankles. I don't know what they loved my ankles, but they lit me up pretty good.
Okay, so we have all these bees buzzing around. You're sort of watching them to help them, you know, deal with diseases. And I take it the financial reason to do all this is what comes out the other end, the honey.
The honey.
So yeah. Talk to us about how, well, first of all, let's talk about the quality of honey. Just is honey honey, or are there varieties of the way it tastes and the quality?
There is, honey is honey. There are varieties on the nectar that they collect. If you have a hive up in the mountains in an area of a lot of pine trees, different conifers, it'll be a very different honey than the Wasatch wildflowers that we have here. Most of mine are Wasatch back wildflowers, and it's a delicious honey. And the best thing you can do is find a local beekeeper and get your honey from them, because that's in your neighborhood, and a lot of that can help. This is not medical, but it can help with your allergies. My buddy Matt in my neighborhood, he started keeping bees because he was enjoying my honey, and it helped him with his allergies. And he wound up, he and his wife keep bees in their backyards as well.
So let's talk about how do you get the honey out?
So they will put them in these frames, and the frames have what's, you see the honeycomb.
Uh-huh.
And they'll put nectar in there, and they will fan it with their wings, get it to the right hydration level, that once it's there, around 15 to 18% hydration, they will cap it with wax, and then it stores forever. So honey is an amazing product. The different compounds that are in there naturally, it's fantastic.
So if you weren't there to take it away, what would the bees do with it?
They would eat it.
In the winter?
Yeah, in the winter. Yeah. So you have to leave them. I leave them 80 pounds of honey.
Okay.
For each hive to get through the winter.
And how much do you take out?
Whatever's left.
Okay,
it depends on how. Sometimes it's, I can usually get 50 plus.
Okay.
So
50 pounds out of a hive. Is that for the whole season, or is that?
Yeah, different times through the season. Most of the harvesting will be done in mid-August through mid-September.
So physically, do you go in and cut out some of the honeycombs and pull them out? Is that what happens?
So you put in a different box. So it would be more of a, honey is very heavy.
Okay.
Very heavy. So you will have a medium-sized box, about 6 1/4 inches high, 10 frames in there. They'll fill that with honey, and you'll go to lift it, and it'll be 50, 60 plus pounds. You remove that, and you can brush the bees off each frame individually, or use a leaf blower and gently blow them off the frames. You put it away, cover it, because they'll track it down. They'll follow. I parked my truck with the hatch open in the back and a box of honey, and I was over at Redstone. I got back to my truck, and there were a couple hundred bees circling around the back window. So that's not fun to do to people walking around. But then you take it out, you remove the wax capping, you put it in a wax, a honey spinner, and centrifugal force will force it to the outside of this stainless steel tub. It drips down, you store it, and bottle it, label it, cap it, and it's fresh honey, raw honey for sale.
And that leads up to, where can people buy some?
Well, I have a website, parkwestbees.com. It's not live yet. It's going live very soon. Busy with other things. And we'll have honey there. And any people who know me, just give me a call or shoot me a text. Shoot me an email.
Is there an email you want to give people to contact you about honey?
Sounds great. parkwestbees@gmail.com. Get on the list, and when the honey is there, I give you a call. We meet up at a certain place and do the transaction.
How long have you been doing this, Kevin?
It's been about 3-4 years.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there. The business is new last year or the year before.
And you started as a hobby and then it turned into a business.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And because I'll also sell queen bees starting next year. So if you have a hive in your backyard and you notice your queen is either overly aggressive, or your bees are overly aggressive, or the queen is not laying as well as she should, you can requeen, and within 6 weeks, they will, all the offspring will be from the new queen, and hopefully it'll be a more gentle.
The personality of the queen affects the way the bees act?
Yes. Something in her DNA makes them very protective. They work hard. One bee will collect a quarter teaspoon of nectar in its lifetime. And you think of a jar of honey.
Yeah. Mm.
So a good hive will have over 50,000 bees at any given time. They live about 6 weeks in the summer. First few days, they're caring for young, building comb, and then they go out foraging and collect honey and nectar.
10 seconds. You plan to expand the business?
I think I'm pretty good where I'm at with the number of hives. If I retired from my day job, then yeah, I could probably go bigger, but this is about it.
Well, we need to have you here on Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this.